Welcome to Universal Soul Lab. This is Detective David Love.
And Dr. Lana Love. Welcome to our show.
Today, we're very happy to have our special guest, Attorney David Gallup, founder of the World Service Authority. David's been our guest on past shows, and we're very excited to have him back with us today to talk about current happenings with World Service Authority. And this is David's first video interview with us.
I'm really happy to be here. Thank you so much, David and Lana.
Thanks.
Looking good.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So where would you like to start?
So why don't you tell us about your background? I mean, that's always a good place to start right from the beginning. Tell us how you got started and how you got started with World Service Authority and a little bit of background about World Service Authority, even though you've been on our show before and done audio interviews with us. This being the first video interview, I think it's appropriate to just start right out and give people a little bit of background information about you and the organization.
Okay. Well, my name is David Gallup. I'm an attorney, as you mentioned, but I'm also a lot more than an attorney. Sometimes people hear the word attorney and they run away fast. But I'm not your standard kind of attorney. I feel like I'm the attorney for humanity, attorney for the earth, which is very unusual because most attorneys are for themselves to, you know, somehow get their clients to give them a lot of money and put it in their own pocket. That's not the kind of role that I've ever had. Because really during law school, I was studying international human rights law. I worked at the International Human Rights Law Clinic the first year it existed at American University here in Washington, D.C. And after law school, I came to World Service Authority, this was in 1992, to establish a legal department for the organization, a human rights organization that has existed since 1954, but had never had a full-time legal staff or legal department to help the many people around the world who self-identify as world citizens, both on a spiritual or symbolic level, but also on an actual practical day-to-day level for many of them, especially refugees, stateless persons, other people who have no documents. They'll come to us, or even maybe have a national document, but want something that is neutral, will come to World Service Authority and say, can you please provide me with this document? And then later on, they might need legal backup, whether it's to help them with an asylum case, to help them to exercise or affirm their right to work. World Service Authority really needed a legal department to provide this kind of advocacy backup to all the people who come to WSA. So when I came to WSA, that was what we established. And then back in 1999, I became president of the organization. So now I wear multiple hats, but my main hat now is certainly more administrative. And of course, with social media nowadays, I'm doing a lot more. And this I see as part of our social media outreach to the global public. So I really thank you and appreciate this opportunity to speak to your viewers, as well as everyone around the world who might want to learn more about the human rights work, the world citizenship work of World Service Authority. So if I had to put it really succinctly, World Service Authority educates about, promotes, and implements human rights, world citizenship, world law, and we talk about creating the institutions of law that we as one human family would need to live together peacefully. So that's really the goal of this, main mission of World Service Authority is really world peace through world law. And it's up to us to come together through the institutions that we can devise in a democratic way to achieve peace. I mean, if you look at what's going on in the world today, and I'm sure we'll get to that here in a little bit, it's very frightening, not just on a political level of national leaders arguing and fighting even over Twitter, but also just what's going on in the background with companies sort of running ramshod over the environment and being able to do that, and some of the laws that have been put in place to prevent that not being upheld in an effective way. So World Service Authority has, of course, a big mission, world peace through law, world law. We've never had world peace before, but we need to start somewhere. And that's why I'm so enthusiastic about, and I've been there for 26 years now, so enthusiastic about working at World Service Authority.
Your organization's been around for a long time, one of the oldest sovereignty organizations I can think of. I heard about World Service Authority when I was in my 20s in the early, at least in the mid 90s, I remember hearing about World Service Authority and world citizenship and became very interested. And I saw your website when the internet first came up. And
yeah.
So, you know, very honored to have you on our show and have developed a relationship with you over the past few years. And I'm Leonard and I, and I'm very happy to that Universal Soul Love can support World Service Authority and its mission for a world peace. And I have a background in law. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in criminal justice, and I've been a private investigator for more than 20 years. And I've worked in the U.S. court system, and primarily 50% of my work was in criminal defense investigations. So, and I've also taken constitutional law, so I can certainly appreciate what you're doing. And Nana and I both have very strong views. We consider ourselves to be social activists when it comes to what you're doing with refugees. We're very concerned about what's happening in the world, and that's a lot of what we discuss here on Universal Soul Love is world peace and so much more than that. We know that World Service Authority represents more than just world peace, but just very comprehensive.
The way I would put it is not only are we seeing the forest, which is this idea of somehow taking those steps towards world peace and making that really happen, but we're also seeing the trees. And I mean, we not only do we work on that big mission, but we actually help individuals along the way. I love it because we're both an advocate for humanity and the earth and for the future, what can be, but we're also an advocate in the here and now for people who are currently suffering, people who are facing persecution, people who are being oppressed. So I like the fact that we can do both. And I love the fact that I'm talking with you as a team, because you from the criminal justice and investigation side and the legal side, and Lana, you from the psychological and human and brain side. I mean, we need you also as a team, as part of our team, to really change the world and to change how we view the world and how what our place is in the world. I think this is it's wonderful that you're able to work together in a team, not only on the show but behind the scenes also helping individuals.
Yeah, we've been trying to do that. We've had some Zoom meetings where we've been trying to with other guests. I believe you've been on Alexander Metter's show on Galactic Connection not so long ago. She's a good friend of ours, and we've been on meetings together to discuss ideas on how we can support each other with our organizations and our missions. And we've had some success. We're getting there. It shows unity, too. It shows that we're collaborating and that we're coming together, and we're all different. We all have our different opinions and missions and projects that we're working on, but we still do our best to try to unite. And I think that's really important for the public to see that we're doing that.
Definitely.
And I think World Service Authority is quite unique in that your aim is world peace and also advocacy of individuals, but you do the support from a legal stance, which you're actually using the system of the present governments to advocate for, you know, a higher level of, I guess, sovereignty of the individuals.
Exactly. I mean, I have this discussion with our volunteer legal staff, because our legal department is staffed by interns, lawyers and law students from around the world. I have this discussion of human rights and international law. And I always question, is international law an oxymoron? How can you have law between equally sovereign states who are willing to wage war as a final resolution to conflict? Mm-hmm. So I challenge the idea of international law, but just because I challenge it doesn't mean, like you just said, Lana, that we don't use it to help people. We do, because certainly even if governments don't respect law as they should, they certainly are embarrassed if you highlight the times when they don't, or if you can take them to a procedure, an international law procedure, whether it's to a regional court or the International Criminal Court, or even, well, between states, the ICJ. If you can expose violations of rights using the present law that's there, we can advance the law to come to the kind of the world law that World Service Authority is promoting, a common world law, so that if you kill someone on the streets of Baghdad or you kill someone on the streets of D.C., Washington, D.C., that should be considered murder. And right now in this system, it's not. And this is why you can have leaders of certain countries, you know, threatening to send out nuclear weapons against another country. And then that other country saying, well, we're going to blow you up first. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculousness. It's madness. It's not something new. This has been going on since the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, this war game. And one of the reasons, another reason historically behind the founding of World Service Authority was Gary Davis, the founder, who had said, look, I was a part of this world war system. Now I want to be a part of a world peace system. He removed himself. He renounced his nationality. And although you don't have to do that now, when you register, for example, through World Service Authority as a world citizen, you do not give up any lower level allegiance. You don't have to. You're just raising your allegiance to that higher level, to humanity, to the earth, so that you can see the kind of ridiculousness that it becomes more apparent when you see yourself as a world citizen, these petty squabblings between states and between the so-called leaders of the states.
David, I wanted to ask you, do you think world peace is possible?
Of course. I laugh only because what would my whole life would be worthless if I didn't think that. No, I really do. And I mean, Gary Davis, the way he would state it, and the way he would, when he would speak to many audiences in person, in theaters and in big venues around the world, he would say, okay, let's all talk to each other right now and agree that we are going to be peaceful among each other. And that's where world peace starts. It starts like as a contract, you might say, between groups of people or people even in one room saying, we're not going to take up arms against each other. We're going to have a peaceful, polite conversation. It doesn't mean there won't be some conflict, and because conflict, as long as it doesn't rise to the level of violence or aggression, is okay, right? In fact, some conflict probably helps us to advance, right? Mm. So he would start that in that mindset or that framework and help the people in the room say, well, we can be peaceful among each other. Why don't we take what we've just learned in this small room and bring it out to the rest of the world? So it is, every day it's a challenge to achieve world peace. I mean, every day it's a challenge to achieve peace with your next door neighbor, with someone driving down the street or walking down the sidewalk. There's
like we've got some technical difficulties.
Oops. Oh, there he is. Okay.
Okay. So, I'm sorry. All I was saying is that we humans have the positive and negative side to us. We can always have the chance to act on the positive side versus the negative one in every interaction that we have. So world peace, just like peace between us here or any humans meeting anywhere, is not easy. But it certainly is achievable. I mean, we've seen within large swaths of land masses, you might say, people acting relatively peacefully among each other. And that sometimes does, I think, require some mechanism, you might call it government or law enforcement or something, that helps people to understand what the agreement or contract is between them. And then if there's an argument, then you go to court and deal with it. You shouldn't have to take up a weapon to deal with a disagreement. So there are large land masses of people that are acting, and even between so-called countries, that are acting peacefully among each other. And it's not a big leap to say we can do that for the whole world. We certainly have the technology nowadays. Language is not a barrier anymore. Culture is something we should celebrate. It's really not a barrier at all. So I see world peace is as where humans need to be striving right now so that we can have that kind of future that some people might say, oh, that's 100 or even 1,000 years off from now. It has to start with us planting those seeds of peace right now.
And excellent. And conflict has a negative connotation to it. A certain amount of conflict does often lead to a peaceful resolution. Everything is about agreements. Everything, I think, in life is about agreements, and there will be disagreements, and conflict comes in when there's a disagreement, and it's sometimes conflict is okay, because if you're unhappy and you don't say anything, it just simmers, and then the other person doesn't know that you're unhappy, so you have to vocalize that and communicate that and say, I'm unhappy and I want change to take place. And like you said, you should be able to do that without weapons, without saying, I'm going to nuke you. And if people have to die in order to solve a disagreement, then we need to come up with a better plan or a better person to, you know, deal with it. Exactly. Or something has changed so that people don't have to die in order to resolve a disagreement. Exactly. And I think that's what we're trying to do. And luckily we have, you know, we're in Sydney, Australia. Normally would say we're broadcasting live from the land down under on BBS Radio Network, just because VBS Radio is a platform that allows us to communicate this way from Australia to the United States or anywhere in the world over the World Wide Web. And it's a great platform. And we do have free speech this way where we can talk, whereas a lot of countries don't have this and it's censored. Yes. So VBS Radio is a nice facilitator of these types of talks and discussions so that we can come up with new ideas and exchange information like this to try to facilitate global peace.
So I guess one of the topics that we wanted to broach with you is the idea of sovereignty, personal sovereignty, and the free, you know, people's innate rights to go wherever they choose to go.
Right.
It's a tricky subject because it's personal sovereignty versus perhaps the need to control some individuals. Not all individuals are equal. Mm-hmm. Most individuals, I think, are very freedom-loving and respect other people. But, you know, you have other individuals that, you know, do indeed want to cause harm. So how do we balance that?
Right. I mean, when I was in my security classes that I took in Australia, we went over conflict resolution and conflict management and minimal use of force, the use of force continuum, et cetera. And also we talked about natural rights. I sometimes call them natural birthrights. And I don't remember all of them, but one of the big ones was freedom of movement as a natural law, which is very pertinent to the mission of World Service Authority. And so how far does that go when people can't always manage their own behavior very well? They don't always take personal responsibility, and they don't always recognize or respect other people's natural rights, and they violate them, violent crime. They enter other countries and sometimes cause problems. And so how do we balance that with the natural right of freedom of movement?
Sure. Well, certainly we have innate and unalienable rights. One of them is, of course, the right to freedom of travel. Another, like we've talked about here, is right to freedom of expression. Your rights end where mine begin. So that means we shouldn't be trampling upon each other's rights. But that also brings in, and I don't think very often, or at least enough, in conversations about rights, universal rights, whether they're planetary rights, human rights, whatever rights, do we actually talk enough about duties? Because we not only have universal rights, but we really do have universal duties, duties to each other, to the planet, to ourselves even, because if you're not happy with yourself, it's hard to be happy with other people. Sure. One thing I learned actually relatively recently, because in law school, you don't really learn so much about natural rights unless you're studying maybe the history of law. But what you might say is some of the basic natural laws are do no harm. Make sure that no harm is done, meaning, you know, watch out for others, and keep your word. And if everybody did that on the planet, we'd have a wonderful world. So it's, you know, I guess it's the question of how do we get people to do no harm, and also from the perspective of looking out to for others, make sure that no harm is done. And of course, when there's humiliation that could lead to people to act in a certain way, having maybe greed or being frustrated in their own life, then they may take that frustration and anger or humiliation and act that out on others. So I really think we need to start, of course, not only with children, but also continue this educational process with everybody on the planet. It should really be part of every school system is how to be a good human, you might say. And of course, people talk about this, you know, what does it mean to be a good citizen? But that usually pertains to like voting or participation in your local community. It doesn't really talk about maybe the golden rule how we should behave as people with other people. So certainly, I mean, definitely World Service Authority is an organization that says that affirms the idea that sovereignty starts with the individual. If you don't have sovereignty, you don't have a right to choose your own political allegiance. That is where you're going to give who or what you're going to give your allegiance to. You don't have a say in anything, and therefore you really don't have any rights. In fact, every national constitution has embedded in it the principle that it's we, the people, that are the basis of the authority of government. So it's up to us to create that government. It's up to us to change that governmental structure if it's not functioning right. It's up to us to really make those rules. I mean, that's one of the things I love about the U.S. Constitution is the Ninth Amendment that says the enumeration of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. In common words, that means we, the people, determine what our rights are. And if we can determine what our rights are, we have a say in our world and how that world is going to go. So sovereignty is certainly a key point for what World Service Authority is working on. But sometimes that scares, I think, national governments when they hear the word sovereignty. They think that it's some kind of people who are going off and trying to get rid of a government or be revolutionary. And that's not at all what World Service Authority is about. We're not saying that we need to get rid of anything. We just need to move beyond what we are. And if I could indulge you real quick, because I saw this earlier tonight, this is Gary's book, My Country is the World. And I just want to read this one little paragraph, because this is, in a nutshell, this exactly explains sort of the function of exposing the system that we're living in and why we expose, you might say, without opposing. And it says, and this is Gary Davis, "One of the chief objects of my gesture of renunciation was to demonstrate that the nation state need not be overthrown, for in fact, it does not exist. Men's minds need only be disabused. The nation state is a whole cloth myth perpetuated by the slavery of tradition, unreasonable loyalties, and pieces of paper, which at best only pretend to recognize rather than bestow existence upon the individual. If I could show that it was possible for me to survive in the world without papers, cross frontiers without a passport, and conduct myself as a free human being without benefit of any national credentials, I would be striking a blow at the very heart of nationalism itself." So it's interesting. I've learned a lot working at World Service Authority about identity. I mean, we're all playing a role here. I'm playing a role as your interviewee. You are playing the role of interviewers. But not only am I playing that role, I'm playing the role of president of World Service Authority. I have family, so I might be playing the role of brother in my family or son or parent or something. We're all playing these roles, but sometimes we aren't. Once again, it's a question of education, taught how to do these roles in a peaceful way, in a way where we make sure we do no harm to others and that no other harm is done. So we have these roles, we have our sovereign choice, and we have the right, of course, to whether it's to travel freely or other human rights. It's in my mind, it's more how do we exercise those rights in a safe and productive and effective way where we can do it without harming others. So of course, if people's basic needs aren't met, then they're going to be upset and they're going to be frustrated and they might not be willing to respect other people's rights because they feel that their rights aren't being met. We are certainly living in a world of abundance, but we're not living in a world where that abundance is effectively shared. Now, of course, everyone is different. We all have different needs and different wants and desires and not everyone's going to have the same intellectual capacity as anybody else. So there's no such thing as true equality. But certainly right now, where you've got, maybe the top 1% of the world and the bottom, 99% or whatever, or maybe not 99%, but a lot lower, we can bring that much closer together. And one of the other main roles of World Service Authority is to bring out the idea that if we use the resources of this planet that we've been so fortunately given and appreciate it for good, rather than for destruction, we have plenty. Even if the planet blooms to 20 billion people on the planet, we probably could feed everybody as long as we aren't preparing for and waging wars and preparing for aggression, because that destroys so much of our resources, natural and of course human, who die in the crossfire. One of the roles of World Service Authority, and I see as my important role, is to get this idea out of what is world citizenship? Who are we in this 21st century? How do we take our sovereign rights and then also share them? I mean, we don't want to just claim them for ourselves, but also share that knowledge, democratize rights, you might say.
Wow, that's fantastic and very, you're just covering a lot of ground with that.
So inspiring.
It is. We had a great interview two weeks ago with the vice chairman of the Libertarian Party, Arvind Bohra, and the libertarian ideals or philosophies sort of go right along with a lot of what you're saying. You know, the mission of World Service Authority and the ideals that you're upholding. It's kind of interesting. There's a lot of similarities, anyhow. Even though World Service Authority is not a political organization; it's a nonprofit organization, right?
Well, actually, I would disagree with that. We are political. I mean, every word that's come out of my mouth, I think, is extremely political. In fact, okay. I think it's revolutionary, but in a peaceful means way. It's I like to say the power of the pen, not the power of the sword. But I mean, it's extremely political because even a discussion of human rights and how people can claim those rights, who you know can claim those rights, etc., is certainly a political discussion. And we haven't mentioned this yet, but World Service Authority, we see it as the administrative branch of a world citizen government that was founded in 1953. World Service Authority in 54. So we are actually claiming, you might say, governmental authority, which does scare some people. I mean, even Gary Davis would say, who wants government? If we didn't have to live with any government, we wouldn't want to. But so it's really a question of understanding the why behind the terminology that we use. And I think for us, I mean, I like to say to people, look, if you say that I can't give my allegiance to humanity and the earth, then I say you can't be Canadian or Ghanaian or Chinese or whatever, because it's up to me to choose who I give my allegiance to. I mean, I wouldn't go back in time and tell George Washington that he couldn't be an American, right? Because he had the right to choose that framework if he wanted to. And all we're saying is we are exercising our right to choose that highest level framework of world citizenship until we meet the extraterrestrials who are out there, and then we create a universal citizenship.
Sure.
Now, and it is really important, and I'm going to be doing a blog on this in the next week or two, is the difference between world citizen and global citizen. We ourselves see ourselves as world citizens, and the reason why I use the word world, and Gary Davis always did, was because world, it's both a noun and an adjective. And it's a framework, it's a system, a world. Global is just a term for, like, it's a world citizen because it's people interacting, participate in that political framework. The fact that we are acting in a political way, but that everyone has the right to participate in how those politics will play out.
Sure, and I understand what you say. You're giving a much broader definition and meaning to the word political or politics or politician. And that's fine. It's we do that in life. We tend to limit our thinking on, you know, the general consensus and meanings of words and terms, which is fine. I think Arvind Vohra happened to say, when we were talking about the Libertarian Party as a political organization, he described it as actually a movement, a worldwide movement, where they're trying to not just, they said if they really wanted to, they could use tactics to get their candidates they could make them winning candidates if they wanted to in order to get their people in, but they actually want to make real change in the world. And so they're really upholding their ideals and trying to spread that rather than just trying to win an election, which is admirable and it's commendable. And it's same with World Service Authority. What you're doing is trying to make true change, positive change in the world, and not just try to overcome some competitor or imaginary opposition, which I think is great. You know, you're talking about not trying to get rid of anyone or go up against anyone or oppose anyone, but just trying to raise the bar a bit, to remove some limitations, some limited beliefs or false beliefs, and try to,
you're trying to transcend current world governments or current nations. I'm interested in the idea of a world government. I'm just wondering what political structure you would foresee for that, because there is a lot of talk about the new world order, where all governments unite. But that's sort of, a lot of people are quite sort of feeling quite uncomfortable with that idea, because there seems to be an underlying sense of a lack of sovereignty and of a domination by certain leaders. What political structure do you see for a world government?
Or maybe we're a new world order too.
Maybe
David Gallup's creating a new world order,
perhaps a fair and democratic world order.
Certainly, yeah.
New Earth movement.
Obviously, the goal is to empower For us to empower each other, for individuals to be empowered. Gary Davis, when he would talk about the United Nations, he would always laud the fact that there are agencies of the UN that are doing really some amazing work, that are helping people so importantly on the ground in the here and now. But then he would go back and say, but nations don't unite. Only people do. So his idea of a world citizen government is a government, once again, that's really of, by, and for the people of the world that we participate in democratically to create, and that rights still reside within us. And so it's not trying to unite the governments, which is in some degree what I think the United Nations had in mind, certainly the League of Nations did, but to unite people as world citizens. In fact, one of our newest projects, actually, is to look at the idea of world citizenship as a valid additional legal status to any other citizenship that you might have. And the importance of that is if you're stateless, for example, because a certain government doesn't respect your ethnic identity, if a certain government says we don't want to give you any rights, you know, because we see you as different, or you're maybe a different religious faith or something, nation state government has the power or control to do that. What we're saying is, if everyone is viewed legally as a world citizen, at least what I would say is a modicum or minimum of fundamental, innate, and unalienable rights would have to be upheld by all the governments around the world for those people. So, like, for example, there's about 1 million people called the Rohingya refugees in Myanmar, and they're stateless. They don't have the kind of advantages that other people in the country do, and the government really doesn't want or hasn't wanted to help them, at least up to now. So what do? They, you know, basic rights, maybe even going to school, they're getting their inoculations, having the right to work and all, are not being met. But these are our fellow human beings. That's 1 million people. Why are we allowing that to happen? How can we consider ourselves, erudite humans in this 21st century when we're letting some of our fellow humans sort of, wither away? That doesn't make sense to me at all. So I guess our idea is to unite people as people. That doesn't mean that we won't have some kind of framework, like you were saying, Lana. And what kind of framework would that be? Well, to start with, I would say that we need, for example, a World Court of Human Rights that doesn't yet exist, although World Service Authority has a draft statute for one. We might need some kind of World Sustainable Development organization to help us to determine how we deal with our global commons, not just the land, but the oceans and the space also around us, and even the moon and Mars or wherever else we might go. And how do we share those resources and that knowledge? So we need a framework that's not just maybe that's not like just a tripartite framework that you might find here and in certain other democracies where you have a legislature, a court system, and an executive branch. We may need more than that, or maybe less than that. I'm not sure, but the way I see it is it has to be participatory. Everyone has to be able to have a say in how the government's run. And of course, you also have to really, I think, raise up the power of local government authority so that people can really feel vested in their local community and participate in their local community, and then only have to deal with global issues when global issues arise. I mean, I like to use the example of the Universal Postal Union. The fact that you can send a letter to your aunt in Shanghai and she gets it means that there are certain rules that have to be followed for that letter to get from one place to another, and you actually have to pay a little fee, which is the postage stamp that you put on that letter. But you don't care who the Secretary General is of the Universal Postal Union, which is really the world government of the post. His name is Bashar Assad, I think his name is. No, Bashar Assad. Bashar, I don't actually even remember his name. It's Bashar something. Anyway, so it doesn't matter that we don't know who he is. The point is that it doesn't even actually matter in this case that we as fellow humans didn't elect him to that post. But there is someone there who is helping to run that universal postal system with regulations that people follow and even are willing to pay, you might say, like I said, a tax or a fee, so that one letter will get to one place to another. I guess that's really, if I had to explain in a way what I mean by a democratic global governmental system, it would be one where it would be functioning in the background. It would still be transparent, but it would be functioning in the background, and we wouldn't need to worry about it so much because it's really doing what we need it to do. Governments are supposed to be a service to us.
That guy's doing a... We appreciate what that guy's doing, and we're going to look him up afterwards. He's doing such a good job that, you know, he doesn't even have to be known. I mean, that's pretty good. That's the highest honor, really.
Exactly, because you know he's not doing something corrupt because your mail is getting where it needs to go.
Yeah, great. You know, I want to every legal document that I've ever seen, and I'm not a lawyer, but it always started with you'd see a legal document that would say a natural person. And it's interesting that that's always the basis. Isn't every person in every legal system a natural person? And you have what you call a world citizen card, and you also have the world citizen passport. Lana and I are both world citizens, and these are our world citizen passports.
Me too.
And we're proud members of the World Service Authority, Lana and David, world citizens, and just wanted to bring that up. The world passports are. I just wanted to mention that. I know that's sort of a feature of World Service Authority, and I just wanted to comment on that. That my understanding of the world passport is it's an identity document issued by the World Service Authority. It's not a government passport. However, anyone can choose to accept this document as a valid document issued by the World Service Authority as a world citizen.
And exercise your right to identify yourself as an individual with rights before the law and to exercise your right to travel. It's both. But let me just bring up this point. So you do have the standard world passport, which you would say, you know, does apply to any person or any human, anyone on the planet who wants to exercise that right to identification and travel. But just recently, I don't know if you knew about this, but we now have a new passport which says world government passport, which actually is meant to help people to say, look, if I'm a world citizen and I choose, in addition to my local or national government, to give allegiance to this higher world citizen government, shouldn't I also be able to carry a document that confirms that, that shows governmental authority? Me, as in microcosm, as the government, right? Because we are each a governor, we're each a legislator, you might say, each lawmakers. So that this new passport, which is available at worldservice.org, is available to both people who have registered as officially, legally, and politically as world citizens, but also people who just want to confirm that, you might say, highest governmental status.
It's a statement of, it's making a personal statement for sure. And government and governance can also have a very broad definition and meaning. And I just wanted to clarify, because I know there can be a bit of controversy around what exactly the world passport is. And it's not a passport issued by any national government, but it has been accepted by many countries, and it can be accepted because, again, we're doing things by agreement. So a government can choose to recognize the World Passport and World Service Authority and allow a person to enter as they would any other passport if they choose to, or any customs officer or immigration officer can choose in any country as an individual to recognize it and allow that person to pass through.
Exactly. And many, many over the years have, in fact, over almost 95%, over 185 countries, territories, and regions of the world have placed visa entry and exit stamps in world passport holders' passports and continue to do so. But you're right, David and Lana, about the fact that it is up to that individual person who is acting as an authority at that frontier, at that embassy or consulate, they have that subjective and arbitrary discretion to assist the person by placing a visa or by placing the entry stamp. And we would argue, though, that as long as a person is simply exercising their right to travel freely and are presenting this document for that purpose and mainly that purpose, then that person should always be recognized and their passport should always be recognized, because we don't know of any national government that has a valid or constitutionally valid national law against the world passport. So whatever is not prohibited by law is allowed by law. And because there aren't any valid laws against it, by law, all national government officials should recognize it. Now, of course, there is just to lay any concerns of or fears of viewers, you know, if someone is acting, of course, against what we talked about earlier, those primordial law of do no harm, well, then, of course, an official should say no, I'm not going to help you because you violated somebody else's human rights.
Yes.
We can't let you pass it because of that. But that's the example of where it shouldn't be recognized. But other than that, it really always should.
Yeah, this is not a document for people to use for illegal activities. It's also not a fraudulent document. You're not trying to subvert any system or do anything illegal. This is not a fantasy document or anything like that. It's a document issued by the World Service Authority for the purpose.
We wouldn't be able to exist in Washington, D.C., you know, six blocks from the White House. And do
That's
what we've
right.
been doing since, well, we've been, we came, brought our headquarters there since 1976, unless what we were doing was valid and legal and was respected by many, many individuals, first of all, but also by many, many governments over the years and many that continue to do so. I mean, people, what I love, and I should tell your audience members who might have world passports, is whenever you get a stamp, please immediately take a photo with your cell phone or a scan if you have a scanner and email us the copy of the stamps that you get, because that proves, of course, ongoing recognition. And then we either put them up on our site or we might have to redact them if it has personal information, of course. But otherwise, we might keep them in our file. And it's also good for us to be able to prove for a particular individual through our legal department that their particular passport has been recognized in case, you know, maybe their passport is lost while they're traveling, when we might have to issue a replacement. It's important for us to be able to show, well, that their previous passport that was lost already did have a stamp from that government so that the person can continue on their trip without hindrance.
It shows credibility and it shows evidence that it's been recognized and that and certainly World Service Authority is a lawfully organized, well-established organization that's been around for a long time. I just wanted to clarify those points about world citizenship, the world passport, and World Service Authority in case there's any questions on that. And I think we've covered that pretty well.
Definitely. Yeah. And of course, people can email us to info@worldservice.org, and we're happy to answer any questions from anybody in the global public about the work that we're doing, what our mission is, how these documents work, or what does it mean to be a world citizen. Of course, we have, you know, many, many years of expertise in this area. I mean, Gary Davis wrote 10 books alone, not counting all of his speeches and blogs and other things that he worked on during his almost 92 years of existence. So there's a lot of written information, historical and really philosophical information about what it means to be a world citizen, what it means to have human rights, how to claim our human rights more effectively.
I think in the 5 minutes that we have left, I'm just wondering whether you might be able to tell our viewers, give us an example of where having a world passport might help them.
Sure. Well, I mean, many people get the world passport from the so-called developed or first world because they see it as an important tool to help bring everybody up, to say, look, I'm a world citizen. Everybody else is world citizens, too. Let's all work together. I like that philosophy that we are one, all one. But there are many people where the world passport has actually meant the difference between imprisonment and freedom, because there are sometimes people who are in a refugee situation or even stateless who have no document. And simply because of having no document, they are put in a refugee camp or in a detention facility, sometimes detention facilities with people who have actually committed crimes of moral turpitude, not just simply trying to exercise a right to travel. I mean, unfortunately, the nation state system usually will, unless someone has a legal basis for asylum, for example, the nation state system will oftentimes arrest and detain people who are simply trying to go from one part of the world to another part of the world. They've criminalized that, when all the person is really trying to do is find a place where they can live, where they're safe, where they can, you know, put food on their table for themselves or their family. And that should really not be criminalized. I mean, no human being is illegal, you know, is the common cliche. But that's true, though. If we're all legal, like I said, as world citizens, wherever we are on the planet, our fundamental human rights should be respected. So for people in that difficult situation, the world passport has oftentimes meant the difference between finding a safe haven and maintaining and continuing their life even, you know, having to hide out until, you know, like an aggression in a certain area of the world has stopped. So really, the world password can be both a tool. Well, people also use it locally in their communities for identification purposes. It doesn't even have to necessarily be just for travel. People use it to open up an account, to enter certain buildings where you might need ID, to establish agreements between people. So that is really important. And by the way, and this is not really an answer to your question, but I think it's important that I maybe finish on this thought, and that is a couple exciting things that have happened just in the last few months. In middle of May, the documentary called The World is My Country had its official world premiere at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival. And it's a documentary in which Gary Davis, while he was still alive, it was filmed, tells his life story, tells why he had to create this world passport for himself because he had no documents after he had given up his national citizenship. And so it's a really personal, a really heartfelt and emotional story. And there's a lot of clips that date back to the mid-1940s showing him in action at the UN and in other places around the world, explaining why it's important to self-identify, or for us to all identify as world citizens. So I'm really excited that came out, and we're looking for a distributor for the film. But some other really interesting things have been occurring culturally, which I thought I should mention, and which relate to the importance of this passport. And that is, in this world that we're living in, which seems to be falling greater now into division rather than into unity, but that a lot of people now are talking about the idea of identity and what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be, you know, something lower, you know, a lower level than human, you know, on a cultural level, ethnic or religious or other level? And so, for example, in Germany, in Berlin, there was a play called Die Welt in uns, which means the world in us. And it was a play where there was a character playing the role of Gary Davis. And then there were local high school students who had fled from Syria and Afghanistan and other places, but had found their way to Germany, who were telling their stories as part of this play of how, you know, what their passport dreams were, or what it would mean to have a passport that allowed them to travel freely around the world. So that's an interesting play that went on. But not only that, there have been at least three in the last like 6 months to a year, three different art shows, one in Portugal, one in the Netherlands, and one in England, that actually had prominently displayed a copy of the World Passport and some other, you know, information from World Service Authority these art shows that were talking about identity and citizenship and traveling and what it means to be humans as traveling creatures, you might say. So it's I find this really interesting that despite the frustrating, I would say, division that I feel here in being in the DC area of you know, whether it's Republican and Democrat here, at least in America, that division, or whether it's the division of, you know, American versus, you know, North Korean or whatever else might be in the news at the current time, that those divisions are really, you know, ephemeral, that those are really temporary. And we really aren't already one human family. We really are already together. And we just need to realize that. And that, once again, whether it's the tool of the world passport, or whether it's the registering as a world citizen, whatever it might be, interacting with World Service Authority through our many different social media accounts, and if people come to our website or send us an email to info@worldservice.org, we can share all those different social media feeds on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, etc., and our YouTube channel. We are trying to get this idea out of building unity, not walls.
That's fantastic.
That's really our continued goal and effort.
I remember we had Senator Michael Brown on our show once. He's the shadow senator in D.C., and I didn't realize he has his own show on BBS Radio Network called Shadow Politics, but he was our special guest once, and I never realized, and I don't think a lot of U.S. citizens realize that D.C. actually doesn't have a vote in Congress.
Right.
And that's so odd to me, and I had never thought about that my entire life as a U.S. citizen. It's a crazy thought. I mean, because to me, D.C. is like a state.
Right.
You're living there, but you don't actually have a vote in Congress.
Right. True. I mean, it's like the license plate says, no taxation without representation. I mean, why are people in D.C. being taxed and they can't have representation in how the government functions? It is ridiculous. But there is, of course, you probably are aware of a big statehood movement to create D.C. into an actual state, like the state of New Columbia or something like that. So that these people, even here in the capital of America, have their rights fully met.
Well, maybe you can see the connections.
Definitely.
Interesting. And I just wanted to comment. Lonnie, you remember there's a very well-known movie, and I often refer to this, even though I can't quite remember it. It was during World War II, how the Jews avoided concentration camps by trying to get out of Germany, and they'd have to change their accents, and they'd have to create paperwork or identity documents in order to escape death.
Right. Yeah.
And this is almost like what you were talking about with the world passport. Some people are getting out of life and death situations. They may not be, hopefully not terrorists or criminals, but they're trying to escape out of.
By the way, just real quick to answer that point. We have a compliance program and we vet every single person who applies, and we will not, of course, issue a document to someone who has harmed somebody in the form of terrorism or other criminality like that. We do not.
Sure. Nobody's upholding that kind of behavior. Obviously, that's completely opposite of anything that Universal Soul Love, or I'm sure World Service Authority, we're not interested in that sort of thing, and that's not part of our ideology or philosophy here. And so, in fact, you know, world peace, I mean, global peace is what we're talking about. So the idea of that's completely, and, you know.
You have to have peace everywhere to have global peace, so it makes sense.
People trying to get out of these life and death situations just to get the opportunity to be heard somewhere else in a safe haven and go through a fair process where they can have their natural rights respected and upheld is very important. And sometimes, just as in Nazi Germany, that occurred. People had to do these things and create these documents and identities. And many times on Universal Soul Love, identity is a very deeply philosophical topic that we get into quite a bit about who am I and what is identity.
Sure.
So it's interesting. It's not, it is at the basis of law at a certain level, but not often addressed in law, I guess, in a practical way.
Well, thank you for being on our show. It's really interesting to hear about the World Service Authority and the principles that you aspire to, and you know, hopefully someday world peace. That would be wonderful.
Actually, it's up to us. We've got to make it happen.
Yeah, and we're working on it. We're doing it now, and we're doing it thanks to BBS Radio Network, and that we're able to do this here from Australia, broadcasting worldwide on the World Wide Web, talking to you in the United States. These are exciting times, interesting times, and here we are in action doing it now in the present moment, and we're trying to make a difference, and just appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity. It's always wonderful for me to have the opportunity to speak with you, and I'm looking forward to our personal conversations that we'll have over the next few weeks to engage in what we've talked about tonight.
Thank you, David Gallup.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And goodbye to all of our listeners from Universal Soul Love. Catch you next week.
See you next time. Bye for now.